You're listening to an event podcast from the Brookings Institution.
Welcome, everyone, to Brookings Governance Studies Program. I'm Norm Eisen, and very pleased to welcome you to our event on the campaign finance crisis in America and how to fix it, a solutions summit. The United States is confronting as you will hear today from our distinguished panelists drawn from every walk of life, the United States is confronting a crisis. The Citizens United case and other judicial decisions in and around that have combined with a variety of other factors to unleash a flood of biblical proportions. Dark money is swamping the system and bringing a variety of ailments with it. The situation is catastrophic, and it calls for solutions. Rather than being among those who wring their hands and believe there's no hope to repair this situation, our distinguished panelists and interveners today are going to be addressing the crisis. Hello, Mr. President. Our distinguished panelists and interveners today are going to be addressing the crisis, the aspects of the crisis, what its exact diagnosis is. You can't cure the disease unless you understand its elements. But they're going to do that with a focus on solutions. So we'll think about the concrete steps that can be taken and that are being taken. They're not always popularly appreciated or understood, but there have been literally hundreds of reform measures in the states and at the municipal level that show real promise of solving this problem, as well as promising solutions that can work on the federal level. And then we will analyze why we need not wait for these solutions, but the time is now to find those solutions. So we'll begin with a keynote speech by FEC Commissioner Ann Revell, introduced by Trevor Potter. They'll go on right after we enjoy a video describing the aspects of the situation that confronts us now. And that will be followed by three panels. The first one, analyzing the problems, chaired by Tim Romer. The second one, I will chair, addressing the solutions. And the third one, chaired by Issue One's Nick Penniman, explaining why the time is now. And I would be remiss if I sat down without thanking our fantastic Brookings team, Kurt Lynn and Liz and Anna and everybody at Brookings who have made this possible. Even for Brookings, this is a very large number of distinguished speakers and distinguished audience participants. And we hope, as we plan this, because there are so many experts, and I see you, out there in the audience. Because there are so many experts, we hope that the conversation today will be like a dinner party, admittedly a very large dinner party. We are feeding you as well. And so we've asked our speakers to, for the most part, limit themselves to 3 minutes each, so we have the vast majority of the time in all of the panels to take questions, comments, ideas, and input from all of you, and to really mix it up. And don't be shy about challenging our speakers on their analysis of the problem, their ideas about solutions, and their explanation of why the time is now. I also want to thank Issue One, which is supporting us on this event, and have worked with us very closely. Nick Penniman, who I already mentioned, David Simpson, the chairman of the board, John Rao is here, and everybody associated with Issue One and the Reformers Caucus. Thank you. And I want to thank Dan Berger, who is here somewhere, also for supporting the event. I want to emphasize, highlight, of course, Brookings independence, the independence of those who are appearing in their personal capacity on our panels associated with these various events. And I want to thank all of you for supporting the event by being here. Okay, and with that, I'm gonna take my seat, and we will enjoy a video from former members of Congress describing the problem that is confronting us, the crisis of campaign finance, and the solutions. Thank you for being here.
We always talk about the good old days. The good old days were pretty good. Compared to where we are today, the system worked. If you tell me that the problem of money in politics, the distortions that it creates, is just going to keep getting worse, shoot me. Shoot me. I got 17 grandchildren. I cannot live with myself at the thought that they have to grow up in this kind of a world. There's something fundamental we better address pretty quick, or this country is going to be digging a deeper hole every day.
I think we have reached a crisis proportions when it comes to money. A member of Congress devotes almost one-third of every day to raising money. How does money enter and interfere in what a legislator wants to do? You're spending that kind of time raising it.
And you remember there was a case a few years ago of a guy who was charged with giving $300,000 to a campaign. And they asked him from the bench or from the hearing room, why did you give that? And he said, access. To me, that's being on the take. And then to have to read in the paper that all the politicians go to sit at the feet of some guy in his private digs, scuffling along the floor on their knees, you know, supplicant, you know, I need money. I wouldn't do that for anybody. That's disgusting.
That's the problem, and that's part of the why the Congress is so dysfunctional today, is they just don't spend the time legislating. People leave on Thursday, they come back on Tuesday, they try to govern on Wednesday these days, and you can't run a country this complicated with the challenges we face and spend so little time doing so.
Money today in the American political system has gone beyond just corrupting the system. I saw it in the Congress. I saw it when I was Secretary of Defense. I'll give you a good example, Secretary of Defense. We asked the Armed Services Committee of both houses to allow us to do our jobs and phase out old platforms, old planes, old ships that we don't need because we have new technologies coming in. Huge costs to maintain those. So the money starts to flow in to influence. Well, they go in and they start to say, well, you know, I mean, we'll have to shut an assembly line down in 2 years in your state, in your district, and if you let this happen. And so the things that need to be phased out for the good of the country, the good of our security, by the way, those decisions don't get made because of that influence from the outside. Disclosure, transparency, that's where it's really got to start. And not just a facade of disclosure, but real. Every dollar in and every dollar out and where those dollars go to, all the way through, start to finish. That's where you must start.
So number one, a complete disclosure. Number two, let's roll this back by finding a way to overturn Citizens United. And then number three, let's give the Federal Election Commission some sort of vitamin B12 industrial shot in the backside and say, you know what, if you're not going to do your job, you don't get paid. Ultimately, the American people can fix all of this by sending people to the U.S. House and U.S. Senate that will vote the right way and do the right thing on these issues.
So there's a great deal of concern in our country about lobbying and money and special interests and legislators. And what is this connection? Where is it legal and where is it nefarious or insidious? We talk about states being laboratories to fix this problem. South Carolina stepped forward with a solution, delinking the money and the lobbyist and the legislator. You can still lobby, you just can't give directly to somebody in the legislative branch.
There are plenty of things that we can do if we simply mobilize around the conviction that you've got to break this bond between policy and money. I look at history. There have always been moments in America where we didn't think things were possible, and yet they became possible. I mean, that was what the abolitionists were all about. That's what the suffragists were all about. That's what the civil rights movement was all about. We can do these things in America. That's the magic of our system, that the people can actually affect change as long as they believe they affect change. And quite frankly, if we don't find the answer, the future is not going to be bright for America. If we do find the answer, there's no question we're going to lead the world for the next 50 years.
This is not a red state problem. It's not a blue state problem. Across the heartland, across America, the left, the right, the Democrats, the Republicans, independents, we all need to work together to fix this. That's why this bipartisan Reformers Caucus is one of the most unique caucuses in the history of our country. These are Republicans and Democrats, former legislators, people that know the system better than anybody else. Enough is enough. Let's restore our democracy. Let's fix this big problem before it results in, as John Adams said, the suicide of our own democracy.
That was incredibly impressive. That's a great way to start today. It makes me feel just a little awkward following it. I don't have those production values. So is there a way we could get just a couple of those reformers on the Supreme Court? That would be an awfully good start. I've been very impressed by the launch of the Reformers Caucus. I think it's a important next step in this battle, and Issue One has done a great job in doing it. I should say I'm always happy to be back at Brookings as a non-resident senior fellow, I think is the title, and also a senior advisor to Issue One, so I've been following the Reformers Caucus carefully. I come before you today with both good news and bad news, and it's the same news, and that is we have been here before. 109 years ago this month, Congress passed one of the first major laws geared toward reducing the corrupting influence of big money in politics. The Tillman Act of 1907 banned corporate contributions to candidates for federal office and was enacted in response to a crisis in money in politics that has many similarities with the one we are confronted with today. In the early 20th century, waves of secret money swamped our elections, much of its sources hidden from the public. More and more citizens felt that government had become a tool of campaign contributors rather than responsive to average voters. State legislatures and Congress were seen as in the pockets of economic interests who perverted legislation to serve private purposes rather than the public good. Disgust with this system spanned the political spectrum, from progressive Democrats to establishment Republicans. Elihu Root, the prominent Republican New York City corporate lawyer, who later became Secretary of State under President Theodore Roosevelt, declared that the influence of big money was, and I quote, "a constantly growing evil in our political affairs, which has, in my judgment, done more to shake the confidence of the plain people of small means in our political institutions than any other practice which has ever obtained since the foundation of our government." Slightly formal language, but very much what we're hearing and feeling today. As a result of these concerns, Congress enacted significant campaign finance reforms in 1907 and again in the 1920s and yet again in the 1940s and in the 1970s post-Watergate and most recently in 2002 with McCain-Feingold. I suppose one cynical lesson which could be drawn from this history is that reform is impossible. Money will always find a way. I believe, however, that the correct conclusion to draw from this troubled history is a different one, that eternal vigilance is the price of liberty. True, money will always try to find a way into politics, but our democracy will only survive and succeed if its leaders push back against this excessive influence, maintaining the flexibility and foresight to adopt new policies to regulate in the face of new challenges. Today, we face many such challenges. One is that five Supreme Court justices see our Constitution and political system in a very different way than most of their predecessors did. They appear opposed, both ideologically and temperamentally, to any regulation of money in politics, and heedless of the consequences for our democracy, no matter how disastrous. But as the consequences of their flawed policies become clearer by the day, even some of them are forced to acknowledge, as Justice Kennedy recently did, that the system is, quote, not working the way it should, close quote. Another challenge is the Federal Election Commission, which has been transformed from a vitally important agency that emerged as one of the great triumphs of the post-Watergate reform movement into an actual impediment to enforcement of the law. And I should know, I used to be the chair of the FEC. In my time in the commission, I worked hard to enforce the law, both zealously and even-handedly, and even though we regularly confronted issues that touched on some of the most controversial political questions of the time, the commission almost never deadlocked 3-3 along partisan lines when voting on enforcement matters. FEC Chair Ann Revell, who will follow me to this podium, will tell us just how destructive the current partisan paralysis at the commission has become. The challenges we face today are the result of several failures of our system of government. The failure of five justices on the Supreme Court to recognize the reality of money's corrupting influence. The failure of the FEC, IRS, and other regulators to enforce the important campaign finance laws that the Supreme Court has left on the books, such as contribution limits and full disclosure of money spent in elections. Then we have the failure of Congress to enact new legislation in response to this crisis, such as citizen funding and FEC reform bills that have been proposed. One reason for this is that Congress, as we saw in the film, has become completely addicted to the current flawed model of campaign funding. Fundraising weekends at resorts, many hours of breakfast, lunch, cocktail receptions, and dinners in Washington, plus call time for hours every day that members are here, has changed representatives into beggars and given well-financed interests a near stranglehold on their time and attention. Democratic Congressman Stephen Israel, who will be with us today, has just announced his retirement from Congress, citing insatiable demands for time for fundraising as a principal reason. Republican Congressman David Jolly has just proposed that members of Congress be banned from soliciting contributions themselves while in office to address this problem. These combined failures have created a government derided by the left as a corrupted political system that promotes economic inequality by enacting policies favored by billionaires and corporate interests. But it is also derided by the right as a corrupted political system that promotes crony capitalism, union entitlement, and government waste. And, most importantly, it is a system derided by voters. More than 80% of voters of both parties, according to one recent poll, believe that the government and our political system is out of touch with the average citizen it is meant to represent. We are gathered today to discuss what can be done and what should be done, indeed, what must be done to resolve this crisis. And we are gathered not a moment too soon. Now, FEC Chair Ann Revel will give us her keynote analysis of the FEC and what can be done. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Trevor. And thank you, Norm and Brookings, for organizing this really important and timely summit. A vast majority of citizens, as has been said, of every political affiliation are deeply troubled about the state of campaign finance and its impact on our country. So bringing people of such diverse perspectives here today to discuss the crisis in our representative democracy and to consider tangible solutions is a major step forward. Voter turnout in the last election was at the lowest since World War II, and those people who did vote were far more polarized than ever before. Far fewer individuals are contributing to campaigns, while the total amount of money that is being contributed has skyrocketed. Meanwhile, a large number of predominantly minority and poor people, including voters, are not being engaged by the campaigns because micro-targeting is solely focused on likely contributors or voters. The resulting disengagement from politics and from government will inevitably create a permanent class of outsiders and further exacerbate the crisis that we see today. As the agency that was meant to ensure fairness in the electoral process, the FEC, as Trevor said, is really important. It should be a leader in restoring public confidence in political institutions. Instead, though, the FEC is broken and ineffective. But at its worst, it has a major responsibility for causing the crisis that we are experiencing now, and I'll tell you why. But first, I have to set the record straight about the FEC. Those who defend its current dysfunction claim that the FEC was intended to do nothing. They attempt to hide behind recent Supreme Court decisions to argue that there must be sensitivity in enforcing the remaining law. And they claim that the FEC has no authority to require disclosure of campaign spending because, after all, Congress didn't pass the Disclose Act. Nothing could be further from the truth. The Supreme Court's recent decisions explicitly rely on effective enforcement of disclosure laws, and Congress has charged the FEC with enforcing all campaign finance laws, including disclosure. No further legislation or direction from Congress on this is necessary. Additionally, to say that the FEC was intended to stalemate is absurd. Congress established the FEC in the wake of the biggest scandal and constitutional crisis in this country since the Civil War. Its purpose, as the congressional record clearly shows, was to restore public trust by providing full disclosure of campaign finance transactions and to encourage participation in politics. Yes, the FEC was intended to be balanced in its enforcement, but it's utter nonsense to say that Congress intended to establish a disclosure and enforcement agency after Watergate to do nothing. Congress created an agency to investigate, excuse me, and penalize illegal behavior. The FEC has an obligation to enforce the laws that have been upheld by the courts. It's not the FEC's job to divine what the Supreme Court might decide in the future. The fact is, the Supreme Court and many lower courts have actually affirmed the very parts of the law that are the most important to us in this election. Disclosure of all sources of political spending and the prohibition of coordination between candidates and independent spending groups. Unfortunately, the FEC commissioners who routinely vote as a block don't believe in either the purpose of the FEC or the governing law. As a result, they continually undermine the effectiveness of the agency in large and in small ways. I want to make it clear, though, while the block that I mention manifests itself by party, the divide on the commission is not partisan. It's ideological. And here's a few examples of the dysfunction. And trust me, only a few, because I was only given 15 minutes, but I could talk for hours. Though the Supreme Court has affirmed the impropriety of coordination between candidates and outside groups as a protection against corruption, the commission has actually created loopholes to allow coordination. The commission permits a candidate to attend a super PAC fundraiser and speak, even if there's only two people in the room. That's not a fundraiser, that's a meeting. The commission has also authorized a candidate's campaign consultant and a congressional chief of staff to solicit unlimited sums of money for a super PAC supporting that same candidate. That's not independence. That's teamwork. The unlimited amount of coordination that the commission permits is probably best exemplified by its unwillingness to even investigate a case where a candidate's mother ran a super PAC expressly supporting her daughter's candidacy. The bloc adamantly refuses to merely clarify outdated rules on coordination to account for the existence of super PACs. The consequence of all of this is very real. There is now a profusion of single-candidate super PACs which appear to be coordinating with candidates, controlling and even running campaigns. Yet the commission has never investigated a single super PAC coordination case. Purposeful delays by the bloc mean that any decisions will be made long after they matter to the voters. We are just now considering complaints from the 2012 election. That's 4 years ago, an eternity in politics. Commissioners hold over cases allowing the statute of limitations to run and reducing our ability to impose penalties. The gaming of the enforcement system isn't a secret. In fact, in a public meeting last summer, Commissioner Goodman justified his decision to hold up cases during his chair year because the respondents were conservative Republican groups. When a case is considered, any enforcement of significant violations is rare. Thank you. I have it down here somewhere. In closed meetings, some of the commissioners act as if they are the attorneys for the respondents, cross-examining the FEC's nonpartisan career lawyers for their recommendations. The repeated attacks on FEC lawyers contributes to the notoriously low morale at the agency. But the bloc then refuses to investigate unless there is irrefutable evidence that a violation occurred. This is preposterous. As the FEC's own policy says, investigations are appropriate when a complaint credibly alleges that a significant violation may have occurred. That's all. That's a very low standard. And if the bloc finally agrees that the facts are clear and there was a violation, even an egregious one, they won't impose meaningful penalties. Here's what I mean. In 2006, the average fine was $179,499. In 2014, it was 12,890. As election spending increases dramatically, penalties have plummeted. In a recent case involving a former candidate who actually admitted to spending campaign money on personal uses, like at a Build-A-Bear workshop, which doesn't have a lot of relationship to the campaign, the bloc was only willing to seek a penalty on a very tiny, tiny fraction of what he actually used. Even when the FEC should be protecting donors, it's a struggle. The FEC has evidence of PACs which spend the vast majority of donors' money on their own staff, with none of the funds going to the candidates they allegedly have raised the money for. Yet the bloc wouldn't ask Congress for authority to protect the donors to those PACs. Possibly the clearest example of this, you know, see nothing, hear nothing, do nothing bloc is its refusal to prevent foreign money from influencing American elections. The law prohibits foreign money in all elections, but the bloc wouldn't even investigate a clear violation involving foreign money in a California ballot measure, saying that our rules are unclear. Then they refused to do a rulemaking to clarify the rules. We all know about, and it's been mentioned, the scourge of dark money in our elections. More than four times as much dark money has been spent at this point in the election cycle as was spent at the same time in 2012. The FEC has not enforced the unambiguous law requiring these groups to register as political committees and report their donors. The Federal Disclosure Agency is actually encouraging the proliferation of dark money. This disgraceful state of affairs at the FEC is common knowledge among political insiders. Candidates and elected officials are aware that they won't be held accountable for breaking the rules. And that has led to much of what we now see, a free-for-all benefiting a few and alienating everybody else. 84% of Americans say that money has too much influence in politics, but most think that nothing can be done. As the American people and law-abiding candidates rightfully expect the laws to be followed. When they're flouted without consequence, people lose confidence in the process. These irresponsible actions of the commission have led to further distrust of government and disassociation from the political system. Studies have shown that people who are disassociated from the system are more likely to have little respect for the law. As Joseph Stiglitz has pointed out, effective government requires shared action, and trust is necessary for shared action. Without it, acceptance of the law and the reliance that business depends upon, such as in adherence to contracts, will break down. We can't resign ourselves to the campaign system, finance system that we now have. Citizens have to be active participants in militating for change. I know that today's event will provide the solutions that people need. There are, as Trevor mentioned, bills in Congress, and one yesterday was introduced to remedy problems at the FEC, and I do hope that Congress will take action. There's also a simple fix. The term of every other commissioner has expired, many of them long ago. I've suggested, and other panelists will discuss, a blue ribbon committee to identify potential commissioners of stature. Additionally, there are many internal processes at the FEC that could be changed to make the commission more accountable to the public. Most importantly, we have to find ways to get people civically engaged. People must be incentivized to be involved politically and in government. Technology can be a really important tool, but ultimately, I think we have to do the hard work to help people recognize that their participation really does matter. It's said that campaign finance issues, and many people have told me this, I'm sure they've told others, that they'll only be addressed when there is a scandal. The truth is that campaign finance today is a scandal.
I am really looking forward to hearing the views and recommendations of the panelists on how to address this crisis. Thank you.
Thank you, Ann. And we've asked three of our distinguished audience to prepare a short three-minute interventions, and then we'll open it up to the floor. First, I'd like to call on Peter Schweitzer, the author of Clinton's Cash and the president of the Government Accountability Institute. And Peter, you can come on up to the podium. That'd be great.
Thank you. Thank you. Well, thank you very much. It's a hard task to follow the very thoughtful comments from the chairwoman and from Trevor Potter. Let me just begin by saying that I come at this from a slightly different perspective, in that I think the paradigm with which campaign finance reform is often looked at is what I call the Mr. Smith Goes to Washington paradigm. And the paradigm is basically like that great Jimmy Stewart movie, that you have public officials that come in and you have these outside influences that are trying to corrupt them. And so the paradigm becomes one of essentially a form of bribery. I would contend that increasingly today the problem is more one of extortion, that the challenge is not so much from businesses that are trying to influence politicians, although that certainly happens, but that businesses feel and are targeted by politicians in the search for cash. Think about it this way. What you have with money in politics is an influence marketplace. And you have buyers of influence, which would be these outside interests, corporations, labor unions, et cetera. And on the other hand, you have sellers of influence. That would be elected political figures. What happens when we regulate most marketplaces in the United States? Insurance industry, finance. The vast majority of the regulatory burden is placed on the sellers of goods and services. And I would contend that we need to adopt a similar approach when it comes to campaign finance reform. I'm not saying that there isn't grounds for good common sense restrictions on the activities of donors. There are. But what I am saying is that I think a lot of the problem is related to a political class from both political parties that are trying to create demand for their services. And the example I would use in this case would be the high-tech industry. The high-tech industry 20 years ago gave very few contributions of any sizable proportion to political campaigns. Today, they have some of the largest lobbying operations, and they give some of the largest sums of money. Why did that happen? Did they just wake up one morning and say, we decide to give our money away? No, it's because they face an increasing regulatory regime that in a sense required them, or they felt compelled to become involved in the process. So what I would contend is we ought to look at solutions that regulate the sellers of influence, not the buyers of influence. An example that I proposed in a book I wrote called Extortion is, do in Washington, D.C. what is done in already 29 state capitals, including Florida, where I live, where there are laws and rules that say specifically that a politician, when the legislature is in session, cannot solicit or receive campaign contributions, period. Now imagine if we did that in Washington, D.C. If nothing else, we would get a lot shorter congressional sessions. Thank you very much.
Okay, and now we'll ask John Pudner, the executive director of Take Back Our Republic, to come up to the stage. And John is going to plug this new book by Richard Painter. I'm going to do the pre-plug. Richard was supposed to be with us today, and then there was a family emergency. He couldn't join us. Everybody's fine. To announce the publication of his new book, outstanding analysis from the conservative perspective of why campaign finance reform is needed, taxation only with representation, the conservative conscience, and campaign finance reform by my friend Professor Painter, who was the ethics czar in the Bush White House, my counterpart in the administration that preceded Obama. And I will say one last word of introduction of John. One of the thrilling aspects for me, for all of us here at Brookings in putting this event together, was to realize that the strength of feeling and emotion on both sides of the aisle, and indeed on every point of the
political spectrum from right to left on this issue, both by leaders but also at the grassroots, is equally strong, and we have wonderful representation from every part of the political spectrum, including John.
To emphasize that point, I'll start with a confession that Chair Ravel was the first Obama appointee I ever complimented on anything. So quick story behind that is prior to launching Take Back Our Republic, I ran conservative campaigns, and we did feature the president a lot in commercials, but it was generally to motivate voters. But then Breitbart ran a piece by me shortly after starting this up, and the piece was on this absurd Los Angeles case in which a porn company contributed to an American vote. This company was international, wasn't American-based. It was founded by a German who had been indicted for tax evasion. And I read this case and said, boy, I've talked about gridlock in Washington during campaigns. Talk about gridlock in the FEC. How did these guys not investigate this? And to my shock, realized the three Republicans had stopped this from happening and that the hero in the story was Chair Ravel. So I had to go out and compliment, and actually had some of my conservative friends read that Breitbart article and complimented me. And 2 days later, emailed back and said, wait a second, were we on the wrong side of that issue? How did that happen? So it is absurd, just the gridlocks, which leads us to the need for FEC reform. We have, I hate to say, Wisconsin, I think, had a great model, at least at the basis for the formation, which was unfortunately taken out. And so I went up there to complain about that and to browbeat some friends in the past. Just went in the wrong direction, got away from disclosure, et cetera. Made a lot of new friends there who never thought I'd been on their side. They then got mad a month later when I attacked some liberal groups for breaking C4 limits, so, you know, we're equal opportunity offenders. But the point is, we're going to have to be a little bit of offenders. You know, if the FEC is going to be given some teeth to enforce the law, and if they are the body that has to enforce the law so that they, in essence, can stop anyone else from enforcing the law, that's a problem that has to be fixed. So FEC reform has to be central in the makeup and the ability to break ties, et cetera. We will touch, perhaps later in the day, on some other proposals on stopping what we consider illicit credit card contributions in the hundreds of millions, or undisclosed that could hide illicit contributions, on tax credits, which were in effect through both of President Reagan's elections, which we think do bring people back into the vote, and on other disclosure matters, but we'll save that for later. But I'd just like to say, and thank you for the preview on the book. I was going to tell everyone you could get the first copy if you hurried to the back. I was then informed a few people found it on Amazon. We didn't even announce it yet, so you'll get the sixth or seventh copy if you want in the back, but we are giving it away today. But I think if you go through and see the case Dr. Painter makes why conservatives have to fight for campaign finance reform from all different stripes, and much as Peter did in Clinton Cash, Peter points out that Clinton Cash wasn't his first book exposing corruption. You know, we have to be willing, and I think this chapter by chapter takes across where this fight has to go from the conservative side. Thank you.
Thank you, John. And our final intervener is Mike Pietro, the Executive Vice President of the Committee for Economic Development, business organization. And just as we've heard from all sides of the political spectrum, we've found in preparing for today that there's the business is fed up. And Mike is going to share some reflections.
Well, thanks, everyone, for asking me to be here. I want to thank Norm and Trevor and Ann. Of course, your leadership has been paramount, and I wish we had you about 10, 15 years earlier, but it's been great to participate with you. I represent the Committee for Economic Development. We're about 180 CEOs, business leaders from around the country. CED has been involved in a democracy or campaign finance issues, and it goes back decades, and it's really based on the view that a strong and vibrant democracy is good for the country, it's good for the economy, and it's good for business. And that breakdowns in the political system, whether it be corruption or perceived corruption, is bad for our system of American capitalism. So our organization feels strongly about this. So in 1999, we released a study called Investing in the People's Business. Among other things, it had recommendations for various reforms that were reflected in the McCain-Feingold legislation. In fact, Trevor served as an advisor on that committee. And we succeeded in getting 300 CEOs to come out against soft money. And when BCRA was passed, our members were elated. They really felt like they were involved in a good government, good democracy effort. But the air was let out of their sails just a few years later when groups started to circumvent the law. We had a situation where the FEC was not enforcing BCRA. And I have to tell you, we lost a lot of our members with this issue because they really believed as business leaders, you know, if this thing's rigged, why did we go to all this trouble? And so that was a sad moment. But CED kept at it, and we retained most of our members within the Campaign Finance Reform Committee, and we released a study called Building on Reform, which essentially, like other people in the room, it basically said at the time, and this was 10 years ago now, but it said at the time that the FEC is dysfunctional, that it's not carrying out its duties, and that it's not capable of carrying out its duties. And so we held up the Federal Reserve System as a model back then. We really felt like we ought to create a system that looks like the Federal Reserve, and that's that the FEC should be restructured to bring members who are prominent members and come through the system through a nominating commission, maybe similar to those that are recommended at the state level for judicial nominating committees, and that ought to happen. We also believed at the time that there ought to be an odd number of commissioners and that the commissioners, their terms should be staggered. And I'll close with one point, and I see Congressman Romer over here. My business leaders were impressed by the way the 9/11 Commission carried out their work. In fact, we had Governor Kaine come and talk to our business leaders about bipartisan efforts to fix things. And they talk all the time about that effort, about how Governor Kaine and Congressman Hamilton and others came together to fix a problem, and they did it in a bipartisan way. And so my members, business leaders, who are not as political as a lot of the people in the room, their view is, why can't we have a 9/11 commission? Why can't we hold this up the way we did with the Federal Reserve? So they're asking those questions. CED is engaged in these issues, and we're happy to work with this kind of bipartisan coalition. And I would just say that, if we could do it through the 9/11 commission, we can do it through the FEC in its restructured sense. Thank you.
Okay, and now we turn it over to all of our experts in the audience. My Brookings colleagues should be moving around moving around the room with a microphone. If you'd like to speak, please indicate. Any questions or comments from the audience? Well, I'll warm you up then. Anne, what's your reaction to Peter's suggestion that we need to regulate this as we do other markets?
Have to speak. It's not quite in my purview. And maybe Trevor will be able to speak more to that. But certainly, that is what he suggested, I think, is probably somewhat accurate, that's part of the problem. That's part of what's going on here. But I don't think I can really respond. But Trevor is ready.
Trevor, should we regulate the sellers?
I think on this one, all roads lead to Peter's solution. Whether you view this as extortion, and I think it varies and it depends on the circumstance, but certainly I've been in, particularly when I was spending much more time practicing law, representing people who were regulated, I had clients who would go to the Hill for a meeting. Then they'd go back to their office, and the meeting was a professional meeting on a matter of interest to their company, and the person was on a committee, and they had gone to make their nonpartisan pitch. They go back to their office, and they'd get a call saying, I'm a fundraiser for Congressman X, and I wondered if you'd like to serve on our committee for a fundraiser next week. And they'd call us and say, is this legal? Can I say yes? Do I have to say yes? So that extortion side is clearly there. Then you have the buying access influence side, and I think that's clearly there. Then you have the side that simply looks at the effect of it, never mind the cause. The effect is, as several members have articulately been saying now for a while, I can remember Senator Worth saying this when he left the Senate, it takes too much time away from what we're here for. We are paid to go to meetings, have hearings, talk to our colleagues, think through problems, draft legislation, all the things that we think Congress does, and we're not doing it. I heard the head of a foreign policy institute respond to a question of what's the greatest national security threat facing America by saying, well, that's easy. It's our campaign finance system. And he went on to say it's because the members aren't spending time on national security problems. They're spending time raising money. So whichever your analysis is, I think you come back to we've got to find a way to have members come to work and do their work and not spend their days fundraising. And so the expedient which many states have adopted for a variety of reasons, including all of these, of saying you can't accept campaign contributions while the legislature is in session has this effect of saying you're going to have to change the system. Because I can assure you, members of Congress running for re-election can't imagine how they would do that without being able to raise money morning, noon, and night in Washington right now. And if that's what takes that's the impetus to come up with a different way of doing this, I think it'll have the right effect.
Asking the first question. Thank you, Trevor. Whether it's a blessing or a curse, my mic can be heard equally well with or without my voice, with or without the microphone. When President Obama warned in his condemnation of Citizens United in the State of the Union in 2010, when he warned that these foreign funds would creep into the system, there was controversy. Now there can be no controversy that it's happening and is being ignored. We'll hear from this gentleman. A quick question, please, and then from that gentleman sitting on the aisle with his hand up. You were the first two with hands up.
Hi, I'm Richard Skinner with the Sunlight Foundation. My question is, do people see the Federal Election Commission as an inherently flawed entity that needs to be replaced by a totally different structure, such as a single-headed, nonpartisan agency? Or is it just temporarily dysfunctional because of the people who have been appointed to that, and then how can we get better people appointed to the FEC?
Yes, I'm Charlie Clark with Government Executive. Along those lines, within the FEC, is the atmosphere collegial? Are there angry debates among the... how much time do you spend hashing out these issues and versus just doing administrative management?
Okay, with regard to the first question, obviously, ideally, it would be better if Congress were to do something and constitute it differently. But I'm a pragmatist and I'm old, and so I'd like to see change more quickly. And I actually think that the problem, as Trevor said, people used to actually come to conclusions at the FEC. And I really do believe that the problem now is that there is agency capture because of the way that the commissioners are appointed. And it would be so much better if there was a different process for appointing to get people who truly believed in the mission and believed in the law.
I would add to that I think from my time there, the FEC could work perfectly well with its current structure with the right six commissioners. However, with the wrong commissioners, with this split, we have a deadlock that was really unthinkable when I was there. We've learned that we have a structural flaw. So, yes, it'd be great to have the right six commissioners. but to avoid this situation occurring again, having an odd number, having a certainly having a different way to appoint them would make an enormous difference.
We'll take just one more pair of very quick questions, and then I encourage everybody who had their hand up to save your questions, because we're going to delve into these issues for the remainder of the day, and we'll have ample opportunities to call on you, and I'll try to remember who you are. Okay, two quick questions. The lady here in red.
Hi, I'm Beth Tudon with the League of Women Voters of Fairfax. I was just curious about the suggestion about having the FEC run more like the Federal Reserve and how that could possibly be done, organized run.
So at the time of this recommendation, which again was 10 years ago, even the Federal Reserve since then has gotten a little bit more politicized, hasn't it, right? So back then, they were looking for a mechanism or something that they could hold up that has over time seemed to transcend politics and ideology. And they looked at the Federal Reserve as an example. And so it was really held up as kind of a model. It wasn't, there wasn't like we have to pass a law to make it the Federal Reserve. But why can't we have something where you have thoughtful, prominent Americans be part of a commission and you keep sort of the ideology and politics out of it? And maybe it's pie in the sky. But again, you got to remember these guys don't do this for a living. They're executives. They do other things, right? And so their view on this was, well, geez, these guys, at the Federal Reserve seem to have it down. Why can't, And so there is a little bit. Our members are a little bit naive, I think. But I do think that they're thinking about having some sort of mechanism of bipartisan, prominent thinkers. The people that were on this video, those are the kinds of people that they were thinking. All right.